the setup is very expensive and the machines are astronomical. Mm-hmm. Which, digressing, we went and did a road trip to the PRS.
I've never had a conversation with you that did not digress.
When I was in jail with Charles Manson.
So as you can see, Bill Strum here has got a very eclectic and brilliant set of skills and tastes, and has had a pretty wide-ranging career. So today you're talking with us about SEO, but relevant to that is probably the incredible amount of things you've done up till now.
Sure. So
you went to University of Maryland?
I got my master's degree in computer science from the University of Maryland.
Did they have computers back then?
They had computers back then, and I was in the second graduating class at the University of Maryland, and punch cards were the state of the art, and I can tell you stories about impaired states in which punch cards went awry, and et cetera, which delayed the release of the products. But this is probably not the forum for that. Uh-huh. I minored in psychology, which might be considered interesting, in computer science, which probably leads me back to my earlier education, which was system science, electrical engineering, which included 33 credits of math. I decided when I got to Maryland that I never wanted to take another math quiz. Every computer science quiz was a math quiz. And since I really like working with people, I thought psychology might come in handy more than the next generation calculus.
And save you some money on self-analysis.
And exactly right.
So what did you do after college then?
I did what I was supposed to do. We won't talk about my ex-wives, but what I did after college was I was one of the youngest people hired as a full member of the technical staff by the MITRE Corporation. I had gotten a National Science Foundation grant to build an optical character recognizer when I was at Brooklyn Poly in New York, and they were very interested in that technology, and they brought me on board. I stayed there for a couple of years and then went to work for Recognition Equipment, then entered my hippie era and went to work for Computer Science Corporation, where I worked the on-site, off-site, and a variety of NASA contracts. One of my key contributions was I brought the first digital television design to NASA, which was the result in the large-scale displays. Mm-hmm. And we did this in collaboration with MITRE, which was well advanced on that.
You told me a story about some trip you took to Jamaica. Was that about the same time?
I went to Jamaica when I was with CSC. Uh-huh. Okay. Spent
business.
3 weeks in Jamaica out there. I considered it a cultural exchange.
And then you did something with television too, right?
Oh, yes. The resume click for doing the digital television system that NASA did made my resume jump out in the world because nobody heard of digital television in that day.
By the way, we're getting buzzed by a helicopter right now. Unfortunately, we're in the urban warfare zone here. So just explain the background noise.
Just don't let them know I'm here. I was recruited by PBS because I had the word digital television in my resume. And I became the manager of systems development at PBS and led the development of the captioning for the DEF project, which was quite the technological undertaking. It required both a tremendous amount of business acumen, licensing, and legal stuff out there, as well as state-of-the-art engineering, because everything was invented from scratch. How could you deliver digital television and text and context-sensitive things to every home receiver out there? And, of course, since this was funded as access to the handicapped, you had to be able to provide the same level of service to a television as if it were the audio on a television transmission.
So you had to embed it in the current technology.
It had to be embedded in the current technology, and it had to be as robust. So if somebody could hear it, they could also receive the capture system.
Didn't they actually reserve a couple of the lines of resolution on the TV screen? Is that
line 21 of the vertical blanking interval, ingrained in me.
That's going to be important.
What year was this?
This was 1976 to 1980.
So closed captioning goes back that far.
Closed captioning was conceived probably in 75. There were competing technologies out there. There was NapLips, which was what AOL adopted later on. There were a whole bunch of varieties of things out there. France was way ahead of everybody. Alcatel. They all had chipsets that could do it. But we went to an all-American version of this thing that would work with MTSC, which is a different signal format, etc. So we developed the chipset from scratch. Now, developing a chipset that could basically control a digital data stream and have a television receiver built on it in 1976 was quite the undertaking. We went to Texas Instruments, and they said they would love to work on us. It's a good cause. But if we were going to do this, we had to guarantee that we would buy every chip they produced. And it turned out that they had to build 5 chips to do this at that time as the first prototype out there. We got an insurance company to basically say they would underwrite the entire first run, and we got Sears to agree that they would buy the devices that attach to the set-top boxes so that they'd be readily available. And we got them to agree that they would lose money on selling each box.
Wow.
Okay.
And your work was recognized beyond Sears, right?
Beyond Sears?
Well, didn't you get an Emmy for this?
Or yes. We won an Emmy in 1980 for outstanding achievement in broadcast engineering.
That's awesome.
Okay.
How was the after party?
I actually did not go to the after party because I would have had to cross a union picket line in L.A. to go to the party, and that's the truth.
Really?
Yes. They were NABET. Somebody was always on strike, okay? And I made the decision, my staff supported this, that they were all for it also, that we would respect the union and we wouldn't cross their picket lines. They were picketing the Emmy Award and the After Thing Award, so we did not cross the picket line. But I did keep the Emmy at my mother's house as long as I was at PBS.
That's awesome. And so flash forward about 15, 20 years, and you and I had a short stint together at a place called SpeakOut.com.
SpeakOut.com. I became a serial entrepreneur.
Yeah.
After PBS, I decided that I was unemployable, and so I started my own company, which was called Media Cybernetics. Media Cybernetics, the whole idea was that there was the merger of media and the merger of computers through the fancy term of cybernetics. The PC had just come along, and we looked at this as a real platform for combining the two medias moving forward and looking at being able to bring imaging, graphics, entertainment, etc. to a broad base.
So you knew Barbara Dreyer through that company, and then she brought you on as a chief technology officer at SpeakOut, right?
No. Yes. I met Barbara Dreyer through Media Cybernetics. She was with New Enterprise Associates. They became the lead investor in Media Cybernetics.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay.
And then what was your grand vision at SpeakOut? We won't go into it too deeply. It's, we could tell a lot of stories, but...
The vision at SpeakOut was to become a targeted delivery engine for automated content that was created specifically for each user based on their behavioral profiles, which were captured by their interactions with the websites. We were looking at next-generation tools such as Autonomy, which, as you know, was acquired by Hewlett-Packard not that long ago, which was the leading engine. So we did a lot of research into search engines, into quote-unquote AI models, et cetera, out there that could basically...
It was really the nexus of kind of like cutting-edge analytics and survey research.
Absolutely. And yeah. In fact, the survey research, we had numerous partners with doing that, and we created an entire system for doing measurements of user response in broadcast media. For example, we... on the first online dial poll of the campaign debates, and these were picked up by AOL, and we had to guarantee them a system that could support 1,000 simultaneous users all dialing with their mouse at home in response to watching TV.
Remember that when it shut down? I don't know if it was the first one, but it was like the second one.
We have nightmares about that. We covered this for 3 days. It worked 2 out of 3 days. It represented a new achievement in the delivery of interactive content.
I think the issue was something stupid. Like we were capturing the log of all the transactions on the server, and the log just maxed out the storage on the
table
server
storage.
Or
yeah,
it was something pretty elementary. It had nothing to do with the actual technology.
They didn't have one of the parameters set in the first day for capturing, and so they actually it didn't work because they never turned it on. Okay, they realized that about 1 o'clock in the morning after we were going over mea culpaing. Okay. About what was going on with that thing out there.
Well, anyway, so the reason I bring up that experience is because really it was all about analytics in those days, which would have been 1999, 2000. The world of analytics on the web was pretty rudimentary. I mean, you had hits, which I remember was pretty much what everything was based on was hits, which really doesn't mean anything we know now.
Yeah, you have to understand that most business plans written at that time were that I was going to get 15 million people to come to my website, and I was going to sell ads from the website, and I was going to get 10 cents a click through it, and I was going to generate all this money with no recurring costs. And if you looked at the .com, at the bubble, et cetera, we found out this was not quite true. Even though speakout.com did get millions of visitors every day, we were rarely made more than $20,000 a month on the monetization of advertising sold through the site. So the myth of being able to do that never panned out.
Your server costs at that time probably were more than what you were making just on
We had $1 million.
We had an office masseuse. We had a full-time personal trainer in the office. It was pretty cool.
We had over $1 million invested in the server technology. And this is actually anecdotally interesting. One of the investment partners who came in to speak out said, we'll give you $1.5 million, but we want you to come back to us and give us $1.5 million contract. And out of that, they designed a computer system for us, which I then redesigned. But our hosting fees, including the lease fees on this thing, were about $50,000 a month. 1980s, $50,000 a month. Astronomical out there. Their Akamai had just come out there. We were an early customer of Akamai for the delivering of video, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the very interesting things we did was we understood that we needed to measure people's responses. We got a fundamental patent on doing interactive capturing of user response data.
Now that's the garbage truck going by. Pretty soon we're going to hear the fire engine across the street. Just keep going.
It's the gunshots and broken glass that have been disturbing me.
That's when we move the microphones under the table or under the bathtub.
So speakout.com was an extremely interesting place.
And cultural experience.
And a cultural experience out there. The mission that they were trying to carry out was a few years ahead of the available technology to effectively carrying out. The average user still at home did not have much more than dial-up. It was very difficult to have these live experiences out there.
Yeah, bandwidth was a big problem.
So
that was my first introduction to the web, really. And I was the one who coded a lot of the surveys on the front end for what became Intercept, which was...
Right.
Spun off into a different company, which also, I think, folded eventually.
They had was brilliant.
Yeah, learned to do some coding and then struck out with another employee at the company to start our own little gig, too. But since then, Bill, you've been involved in a bunch of things, and in particular, I know you've got a big interest in analytics and how companies are using it.
Yes.
And nonprofits, I should say.
Analytics is an extremely interesting topic out there. And when we think of analytics, we add the other word to it and think of Google Analytics. In fact, the world we're in is a Google-centric world in which we can't escape from their clutches and their proclivities.
Going forward, we should just assume we're talking about Google when we talk about ads. Is that true?
Well, yeah. The Google accounts right now for 66% of all searches. And so rather than talk about the other third, we talk about Google. And we should simply point out that the big difference between Google and the unmentionable others is that the unmentionable others base their rankings only on content, whereas Google only ranks a third of their rankings on content. The rest of it is on reputation and links in and social networking.
But that exact mix, though, is a mystery, right?
Which exact mix?
The mix of their algorithm. We don't know what exactly they're doing, other than sometimes they make announcements saying we're going to take into consideration the responsiveness of your site.
I'm going to hold this diagram up in front of the microphone so all can see, which is the 200 significant factors that Google uses to do their ranking.
But somebody's reversed engineered it. Like, they don't publish
this. Yes, they don't publish. They keep it as a closed secret. The fact that they'll agree that it's about 200 parameters out there. And what these parameters are, don't touch that.
I'm going to take a peek here.
I'll get you the link to it, okay? The way these analytics have been deduced is that people will go and look at the top websites for any keywords out there and then statistically measure the number of times the keyword occurs, the number of words in the text, the number of H1s, where these things appear in titles, et cetera, and build statistical profiles of what they think Google likes based on its rankings. That will give you 1/3 of your ranking. Reputation is the most important thing that Google goes by. If you're the New York Times, you have a reputation of 8. If you're a startup, you have a reputation of 0, no matter what.
What's your reputation?
My reputation is don't let your daughter near me.
Was that the – they used to have the Google PageRank, right? And that was essentially your reputation score.
Your reputation, the number up in the corner that you can see there is your rank. That is the hardest number to acquire. It's only updated every 6 months.
And is that like a credit score that you can't just – is it hard to build reputation rapidly, or is it something that has to be built?
It can't be built rapidly.
So it has to be built over time.
Yes, but if you know your SEO, you know you can inherit a ranking, okay? If you want to get really technical, if I have a website that I'm not interested in, but it's been around for 8 years and it's got a reputation ranking of 4, okay? I could redirect that using permanent redirects from that website to another website, okay? And that website will inherit the ranking of the initial website. That's a really good way of jumpstarting a website to get a good ranking out there. It's also something that people look at when they value a website. But they want to look at what is the website worth? So acquiring a website that might be meaningless, that has a high reputation, is not a vacant thing to do. You're actually acquiring ranking without earning it. You're inheriting
even
it.
Even if it has nothing to do with what you're doing?
Even if it has nothing to do with it.
That'll dissipate the ranking over time.
Dissipate, yes, but very slowly. Very slowly. Ranking gets updated every 6 months. Your reputation gets redone every 6 months.
Is there some black market for purchasing well reputable sites for the pure purpose of this redirect? Is it like a foreclosure black market on websites?
Or, if you have BitTorrent,
I've never heard of this. This
if
is
you
really
have
curious.
BitTorrent and Bitcoin, okay, we can work with you. Now there is a world out there. I mean, I've very successfully monetized a website name I had bought. I bought the name NetX in 1976 or something like that for a few hundred dollars and then sold it in 2010 for $25,000 and regret it. But, website names, the intellectual property, the name of your website should not be underestimated, especially if you've been around for a while and you can have a reputation that basically can be inherited by somebody else.
So is it purely the domain, or is it the actual website, all the content?
It's the domain name. The domain name has the reputation.
So it's just the domain
name. It's just the domain name. You inherit all the traffic. It uses a redirect over to the new site, and it's Google-friendly. Google endorses it. So, they like it.
This is like SEO hack number one. If you don't have a reputation, buy a reputation.
If you don't have a reputation, you're going to be hard-pressed to build it quickly, and it's something you can't go out and tell a client that you're going to do for them magically.
Well, let's start with just talking about what SEO is. What exactly does that mean, and what's the difference between SEO and SEM?
SEO is known as search engine optimization. SEM is Search engine
marketing.
Marketing. Ah, okay. Search engine more. SEO is a subpart of SEM, but I like to use a different term. I like to talk about targeted SEO, which is really SEM. SEO is the knowledge base and technology that a company like Foursight would use to ensure that their clients get the visitors that they want and that the visitors accomplish the mission that the customer wants. And it provides a vehicle through technology that allows the customer to measure it. And so if you look at the available tools on the market out there, some are free, some are very expensive, but just using Google Analytics and a knowledge of what SEO really is, you can sit down with a customer, come up with a strategy, allow them to manage and look at the strategy on a daily or hourly or real-time basis, understand the successes or failure, and make changes in real time that will affect the behaviors of people on their site, helping the companies accomplish their goals. That's the real key to SEO as a technology.
And I think what you were saying before is there's no magic button you can press, or you just can't like buy it overnight. Maybe if you spend enough money, you could. But really, it's a dedicated long-term strategy. It's not a magic sort of voodoo thing that you can
do it once and you're done with it.
Yeah.
The answer is that SEO is a partnership between a company and their clients, in which they come up with what they want to accomplish. SEO basically is the basis for dialogues within a company and between the vendors. Having an SEO conversation and facilitating it within a company allows a company to focus on what their mission really is, because that mission needs to be reflected into their customer face. The search engine marketing, the e-marketing out there associated with a customer out there has to be determined and managed. So I can basically go back digressing, and please, I'll give you a free magic bullet. A free magic bullet, which is the most effective way of getting high rankings right out of the box for a specific website. It's called in-URL. That means the keyword you want to be found in is in the URL of the page.
Which is why it's so important to customize your URLs when you're using WordPress or Drupal or something.
Absolutely.
Because out of the box, Drupal, I think, gives you just the number.
No.
Right?
The understanding what gets ranked, what doesn't. Database-derived sites like ASP, NOLA, and PHP, etc., are not ranked because you're never seen. Because those sites, those pages are not created by a navigation through the site. They're created by a query. When the search engine is crawling the site, they're not making queries. They're just navigating. So those are never found. So an example would be, if I have a product catalog, I should build it as a directory, not as a database. Because the directory...
Like a flat file directory of just a bunch of...
It could be hierarchical. Yeah. It could be a flat file. As long as it can be searched in two levels or three levels to get to everything.
Even if you have your little Google map that you put and publish.
XML site map.
That XML map will not map the things that are inside the database. Mm-hmm. It'll point to where the search is in the database that gets there. But everything that's in the database is not exposed to the Google site maps. Sitemaps are very interesting. They can be your friend or they can be your enemy. An example being that the sitemaps are retained by the search engines. So if I did a conversion from a regular Dreamweaver site into a WordPress site, and there was a bunch of changes in nomenclature, a lot of the phantom pages that didn't get converted are still going to be on the web, and Google is still going to know about them, and then you're going to start getting penalized. You're going to start getting... not friendly for mobile devices, or broken links, or 301 redirects, or all those kinds of things out there that will affect, very small, but will affect your ranking.
So this actually kind of opens up a great question when we're talking about SEO. There's a conversation to be had, how do we increase our ranking as is? But a lot of the nonprofits that I've worked with in the past are either considering or in the process of putting out RFPs, looking to redesign their website. And I guess one of the questions I'd love to propose to you, Bill, is what should you be doing before you go through a website redesign? Is there something that you can do on your website to prepare for this, or something that you would want to bring up with a consultant you're working with or your development team?
I think that's an absolutely excellent question, and I think it's a key question that's often ignored. People consider your website as a pretty face. Your website, the purpose of your website is to achieve your mission. Unless you know, your organization can succinctly state and quantify what your mission is, it becomes extremely difficult to create the website. And I think that in you guys know, in working with customers out there, in their mind, this mission changes arbitrarily and their ideas for the website change and become who pays for it type questions out there. Understanding what the focus and the goals, who you want to reach, what you want them to do, and what you want them to come away with after they've gone through the experience of the site have to be discussed internally and should be the first process of any engagement with a customer. In fact, the customer, to bring in a facilitator for this type of a thing out there, is well advised, because it's going to help them get what they really want, not what they think they want. It's just don't go out there and give me a pretty site and use new icons. It's how do I get my message to who I want? And then how do I measure it? And how do I maintain my currency with it and keep this message going out? And if I want to change the message, how can I change this message without destroying everything that I've done? That's the planning that should go into a well thought out website.
That makes sense. And it's probably just a part of a longer conversation that I'm sure we'll have to take up in a future podcast, because for a lot of organizations, the website is the gateway to getting new supporter or new donor contact information, right? So it's either driving for engagement, it's driving for online gifts or sustaining or contributable gifts, or it's sign that petition, take action. But at the end of the day, it's to get that new supporter's information into whatever CRM or database that you're using, so you can have an ongoing relationship, because it's not a one and done transaction. It's usually meant to be the start of that conversation, and until you have their info, it's always a one way conversation.
So I think what you're saying is very interesting, and it brings up a fundamental point in SEO. How do I get found? Okay, are you going to get found that somebody goes on Google and types in a bunch of words that they're interested in? How do they even know that they're interested in the topic that's your topic or your issue? Okay? So relying only on search engine ranking is only a partial way to accomplish your goals, which is one of the reasons why Google's ranking system in some ways is realistic, and that it ties in social networking and a variety of other things associated with that in e-marketing, and ranks you based on that. So, for example, if I had a mission that I wanted to get out there, the most important thing is you want to create the buzz. I want people talking about the mission, and when they talk about it, I want them to be pointing at me where they can go and find out more. So getting expert bloggers, respected bloggers, high-followed tweeters, all that type of thing out there, to go out there and start talking about what you're doing and using the keywords you want them to, and to have these keywords trend, which is very, 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 very important, is to start a trending of these terms, and to have it all point back and link back to you is probably the most effective way of reaching the person that you want.
So if we've already talked to the client or they've talked to their boss and they've decided what the goals of the campaign or their site should be, and then they're going to, the first step sounds like figuring out what your keywords are.
Yes, the keywords are, I have a social, our mission is a change in trade laws for soap. Okay.
So this is a topic near and dear to your heart.
I'm still finding that this is an issue that I worry about. Chinese soap is the greatest enemy of the American citizen. Just an example is if I've done some real tough ones where they were going after real international projects for, you know, micro funding and that type of stuff out there. And the keywords that are associated with, you're going to have 8 people searching for it. So the first thing you need to get over, it's not volume, it's
quality.
It's quality.
But let's take your soap example. So it's Trade and Soap. So
okay.
Maybe Soap is owned by Johnson & Johnson and Trade is owned by some multinational conglomerate. So are there tools out there you use to figure out what the synonyms of soap are? How do you figure out the combination of those terms together?
In your conversation with your client, the phrases they use to describe their problem are going to become the basis for your keyword searches out there. It's all very specific. You don't want people searching on soap to find your thing. You want the people who are concerned with issues of international trade in which the specific regulations associated with what you're doing are associated with it.
This gets back to your targeted SEO, where it's not just SEO in general. It's you're going after your specific niche where you can actually trend and compete against Johnson & Johnson. In terms of ranking.
You're right, but you're not really competing against Johnson & Johnson. What you're doing is you represent a lobbying organization that's trying to get a piece of legislation passed that may be sponsored by Johnson & Johnson or may be opposed to them. But what you want to do is to create awareness that this is out there and have the people who you want to influence. So specifically, if you were targeting a campaign that was going to go to legislatures, where do legislatures go and look for their news? What do they regularly look for? Can you get an influencer out there in this area to mention it in something that you know they're going to look at that points back to you? If you can get 4 legislators to come or legislative aides to come and look at your site and then clip this and give this to their people out there and it helps them make a decision, you've done far more than get 40,000 unwashed masses to come to your site and read about the issue. Although we want to accomplish that goal and can do it simultaneously, we want to make sure that our target is being reached. And to make a very un-American statement, all visitors aren't valued equally. I mean, we have to really recognize that. We want to reach the decision maker if that's what our site does. If we're selling things, we want to reach the purchasing person out there. If we want to reach a group that goes to the movies, we've got to reach the people who make the decisions in the household to go to the movies, etc. Each is a different campaign. The expertise of companies like you in working with your clients can help them expose who they want to reach and what the message is that they want to go out there and be reached with. So we can SEO a site. We can take all the keywords, all the keyword terms out there. One of the most valuable tools out there in doing this is Google Trends. And that you can go to Google Trends and you can put the keywords in and you can see if they're trending up, trending down, what synonyms are going up, what's going down, what's the demographic, etc. that's interested. So that's one way of helping.
I was going to say, we should take for granted that you've set up a Google Analytics account, you've put the code in your site, you use the Google Webmaster Tools. You're seeing what people are finding your site on. So this information is informing your bigger strategy of, you know, we're going after soap.
Okay, this is now, now I've built a content-relevant site tuned to the keywords out there. And so Google, Bing, and Yahoo will all rank me very high on this content. If it's regional, I can use in-URL. I use in-URL, but I can use in-URL even more to get regional contacts out there. For example, if I wanted to reach constituents in Montgomery County, putting Montgomery County in the URL is going to basically rank very high because the Google search engine uses geolocators. So it knows where you are. It looks at this URL, and so you're going to get there. So that's a big thing. If you want to reach your constituencies in Idaho, having some geocentric content in the URLs, in the titles, in the descriptions, in the meta tags, in the H1s, etc. out there, even in the alt tags that go in the pictures, is going to help you reach your geographic target.
Now, if you're an organization running, and most organizations don't just have one campaign, I mean, those might exist, but usually if they've been around a while, that campaign changes, or there are many cyclical campaigns that come up. But let's take an animal advocacy organization, for example. They might be driving to drive local adoption. They have another campaign to remove animal testing from products. How do you manage that on a website? You're saying, you know, you want to focus, optimize for a target. What if you have multiple targetable audiences? Maybe the donor is 60 and the person who's going to sign your petition, get on your newsletter and share on social networks are 25 to 35. How do you navigate those waters on one website?
This is a very, very good question. And it's something that is somewhat controversial out there among the web design community. My philosophy is that I will build multiple websites that look alike and are interlinked, in which the title, etc., on them is the primary title, the name of the organization, etc. The URLs, the primary domains, etc., are all highly tuned. Each segment within the site is content tuned for these specific things out there. But these, each one of these represents a content. Okay, if you go to the nav bar, that nav bar may, if you look at the other concepts out there, may take you to a completely different URL, which is still the same logical website. And so the search engines give you very, very, very good response. The user really never knows they're being moved from one URL to another because they're not looking at the address bar as they navigate through it. They're going to see the same look and feel, the same logo, the same branding. They're still at the association's logical website, but they're at physical websites.
So that's like a microsite approach. And I can think of a lot of clients like Greenpeace that we've worked with who will spin up a separate WordPress site for a specific targeted action, and then, you know, that all funnels into their CRM eventually.
Obviously, that's a certain level of investment. So it can't be every campaign you run is going to have, you're going to have 30 microsites out there. If you're a small to medium sized nonprofit, if you're Greenpeace, you're going to have 30 microsites.
I have a client that has 40 websites. Okay, targeted specific. This is a product company, for profit. They target them at products and they target them at regions, and they get very good traffic on a lot of these sites. They converge them all back into a central shopping area, etc. They drive them all to fill out inquiry forms. They have it designed so they get maximum competitive view in a product or regional category, and then it brings them into a central core in which you have common interest to their entire user group. This has worked very well.
Well, what's the competing argument about having one central site?
Okay. Google looks often at having a list of URLs as a form of spam. And so you have to be very careful on how you organize your links back into all of these things out there, so it doesn't appear that what you've created is a spam form. So there's some technique and some very specific knowledge about what's kosher and what's not kosher and going out there to do it. Because at some point you can become penalized, and you'll know it. They'll send you a message. The Google will tell you that you're being a bad boy and stuff like that. So it could be used with caution. But to add issues to a nonprofit site in which you have a URL for each issue probably is never going to get considered spam, because it's not going to be an interlocking list. When you come back into the central part out there, you may actually have some duplicate content with the main site, but from a search engine point of view, you're going to get the max ranking on the keyword terms that you want to be found on.
I'm sure anyone listening to this is at least once clicked on those spam links that you're talking about, where you land on the site and it's just hundreds or thousands of keywords that just link to something else. And there's no real content there. It's just a landing page that, you know, at some point in time that probably worked well to rank on Google, but now we'll get you
up until very recently, those were ongoing businesses that would guarantee you links in. And so you would go out there and pay them $80, and they'd put you into 300 directories, each giving you a link in. Links in are something that we should talk about. And this is very, very, very important in getting your reputation up and getting your rankings up, especially with Google. Who is linking to you? What are the backlinks into you? How prestigious are these links? Okay? A little known fact, well, probably a well-known fact, is the most prestigious link that you can have is from DeMuis.
I thought it was Stanford University.
I think it's DeMuis. Maybe they're the same. Okay, the New York Times, Stanford University, Wikipedia, etc. These are authoritative sites. In fact, if you look at the ranking, the reputation ranking of a site, the higher that number is, the more valuable that link in is to you.
So it's a trusted network, essentially. It's a trusted, little bit of their trust rubs off on you.
Yes, there are tools out there, commercial tools, that will look at your site, uh-huh. and they will tell you who you're linked into. They'll look at the sites that are your competitive sites or the leading sites for the keywords, give you the list of all the sites that they're linked into, which, by the way, is a tremendous research tool. It allows you to find bloggers, directories, listservs, all this type of stuff out there that your competition is using to get ranking. And there's nothing at all stopping you from running your, having part of your campaign to be, to also be there. There are also the top-ranked directories. For example, the Yahoo directory is considered to be one of the most important directories to be in. And it's your ranking will jump just by becoming linked into the Yahoo directory. If you go out there and do a free submission, it can take 12 weeks. If you give them $300, you're in there. Okay, some of these things are, you know, not what we consider the web should be, but it's the realities out there. And there's a list of things out there that you need to participate in. If you want to be found, if you want to get rankings out there, you have to have a Facebook presence. It has to be active. You need to be on Twitter. It has to be active out there. The more people that are going to look at you on Facebook, the more it's going to affect your ranking against a competitor who has their site exactly as technically perfect as yours. Now, again, these all have to do with relative things out there. If you're going after a niche, it's not as important as if you're going after something that's national. And if you look at how much some of these big orgs, associations, campaigns spend on social media marketing, it's magnitudes more than what it cost them to develop the website. So part of any web development project out there becomes the associated marketing that needs to be done to support it. And it directly affects the ranking, especially from Google. So social networking, the value of your links in, your reputation associated with you, contributes substantially to it. The number of people that click through your view in Google determines your ranking. Catch 22. Another little trick. In your description on the web, you should have a compelling marketing thing out there that's going to get them to pick you to click through rather than somebody else. So it shouldn't just be dismissed that I've got my keyword. It should be something that's going to make somebody want to click. Because your click-through rate is going to basically affect your ranking. Because it's considered relevance and the users are voting. Social media lets the users vote on how popular you are.
And we're still talking about organic search results using search terms. We're not talking about AdWords at the moment.
Yes. A classic SEO come on is, if you give me $400 a month, I'll guarantee any keyword you want is going to be on the first page in Google. And what they'll just do is they'll take $200 of that and they'll buy a keyword. They'll buy a keyword, your keyword, okay? And they'll make sure that that keyword appears for at least some period of time on the first page in Google.
So that would also argue for, again, trying to be real specific, as specific as you can, about your keyword strategy. So if you're looking for the 60-year-old donor, you're talking about Mucilix, and you're talking about soap, and you're talking about, you know, trade rule number 455, so that people who are looking in that specific combination go there, and your keywords on your pages on your site shouldn't be just soap.
No, absolutely. There should be, in fact, a very, very good point. Never think about using a single word. They're all keyword phrases. People don't think in words. If I wanted to search on sex, okay, would the first name I got be Bill Clinton? I mean,
how can you discover this though? If you're inside the organization, sometimes it's tough to think like somebody that doesn't know about you. And so you can't just go and be like, okay, what would I search to find us? Because that's not really what your supporters were searching. And let's assume you haven't set up Google Analytics, so you don't have the historical information to go back and look. You got to start from scratch. How do you put yourself in the head of your target audience?
Again, this is a very, very good question, and it's something that an
organization... How come you haven't said any of my questions are good questions?
No, you know...
So it's only people on his right side that get the questions.
You don't have to answer that. I don't want to know the answer.
Heming, I respect you, but maybe today's not your day.
It's not my year.
Actually, facilitating a dialogue within the company from a person that's neutral is probably the best thing that you can do for the organization.
That's a great point.
To help them reach their understanding of what they're really trying to accomplish. It doesn't let this bully pick what it is when it may not be what it is. It allows them to create a consensus about what their mission is and to come out of this thing with a mission statement in which the words in that mission statement become the basis for the keywords you want people to find them on.
And we should say, too, the keywords are maybe the metadata actual keywords, but they are also words in the title of the page, right?
And the content.
Okay, let's get a little technical. Your keyword metadata is ignored.
Okay. Well, Matt Cutts at Google, I think, said that last year. He said
it's ignored.
Google ignores your metadata.
Yeah, no, they ignore your keyword metadata.
Sorry, yes,
okay.
Correct.
Okay, they do not ignore your title. They do not ignore your URL, and they do not ignore your description. In fact, the consistency between the URL, the title, the description, and the H1s is one of the highest organic ranking factors for content out there that you can do for a page.
So when you're publishing stuff, that's sort of a time-saving device I've done before, which is just copy-paste into the different forums. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
What do you understand?
If I'm publishing a press release, I just take the title, I paste that title in the description, I paste that title into the title field, I paste that title into the keyword box in my WordPress.
When you end up building a search engine friendly document that's not user friendly, you can do both, okay? But it's you're going to accomplish the goal of being found. What you're doing is you're creating relevance. You're establishing that the message that this is serious for this message, and you're going to get highly ranked. Title, URL, title, description. Okay, and then at least one H1 that contains this out there.
And presumably you don't want to put a short thesis in your title. You should prioritize.
46 characters, I believe, or there's some number of characters. I use tools that I subscribe to and are not cheap. And what they'll do is you create a title. It'll tell you if this title is within the current bounds of what Google is looking for. The position of the keyword within the title compared to the title, is this keyword found in your title? Is it in your description? How many times does it occur in the body?
What's the name of this tool? Yours?
Well, I use the Link Assistant Suite, which is a subscription service out there. It's not the end of the world, but it's you pay mm-hmm. for it.
Okay,
Yoast does a 40% job in accomplishing this.
And Yoast is what?
Yoast is a free plugin that is the number one used SEO plugin in WordPress. It provides you with analysis as you go along doing it. It'll come back and it gives you a report that says you don't have this word occurs this many times. Its word frequency should be increased. It's not in the right place in the description. or it occurred too many times. You don't have a tag. Your site doesn't have enough characters in it compared to what the average thing does. It's first order.
But like a checklist for general best practices.
It's a checklist for best practices out there that will get you ahead of the unwashed masses very quickly. It's a big head start, and it does it right in front of you as you create the pages if you install this.
What's the technical expertise you think is needed once that's installed? Let's say you're a small nonprofit. You get your web guy to install that on your WordPress site. Can somebody who has no formal technical training or background come in and start using that?
The answer to the question is they can, but if I were going to be talking to a client, I would recommend that they build a relationship in which it allows you to train and nurture these people to be available, answer their questions, and review it. And eventually you transfer the knowledge and the expertise and the wisdom of your guys who've been doing it for years to their site. And then they can decrease their dependency on you and the costs associated with it as their internal expertise builds. And that's part of building the relationship except with a client that helps make them more successful and helps a company that's in your business attract clients, keep them, and generate more revenue.
And these rules are always constantly changing. So I think it's one of those things where you certainly could install the module, set up some technical configuration, but SEO is important. You have a website, and if it can't get found by the people you're trying to reach, then you might as well just put it out to pasture. The whole point is to get found, to get views, to get engagement, and drive whatever your conversion is, whether that is reaching a decision maker, whether that's consuming your content and creating volunteer space in your community, you name it. But at the end of the day, if you're not getting found, then your website is not
Let me hold this report up to the microphone. An ongoing part of the relationships between the creator and the client should be continual reporting, if they can't do it in-house or don't have the expertise, on how they're performing, and to set off alarms should something fall off the end of the world. And continually running reports that looks at the behaviors of sites, the number of pages, the page views, most important, the bounce rate, which is how many people look at the page and then leave, where they enter, where they leave, do they move through the site, do they go to the end pages that you want, okay, have they clicked through, have they established the goals that you determine. Establishing the goals of the website are very important. Is the goal of the website to have the person download a document that's your position document? Okay, if that's it, you can measure that exactly. Is it to have them send a letter that you have on the site? You can measure that, how many people sent the letter. Is it give a donation? You can succinctly measure that. If it's a commercial site, what did they buy? If they did buy it, you could actually take the cost of your campaign and what they do and have a continual real-time ROI report out there. Google Analytics is set up to do this, so you can instrument the site to a next level of detail. Just doesn't tell you what pages, it tells you what happened. You can monetize visiting and events within the site, so it can give you back a report that actually tells you if you're making money or losing money on a campaign. Now, okay.
I was going to say, you've brought up a few good things I want you to expand on. Can you actually go into what bounce rate is? So what defines when you leave the site? Is that you clicked a link to some external website and that loaded in the page, now you've left the site, you've closed out the tab, you've clicked another link?
A bounce is I enter and leave the domain from the same page.
Wouldn't this be difficult to get a holistic view for that client you were talking about earlier that had 40 different domains that they were managing, and you could potentially be bouncing from one of your domains to another one of your own domains?
In cases like this, specifically, we measure the performance of the site by the revenue. Okay?
What's that?
Huh? At the end of the day, revenue. QuickBooks tells us how good our website is.
Yep.
Okay. We look at the bounce rate. That's very, 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 very important. And we want the bounce rate to be continually decreasing. The lower the bounce rate, the more relevant the site is to the customer. If they came in and left, it meant you did a very good job on your SEO, but the content that you put on the page wasn't relevant to what they were looking for. Okay? And so you need to understand what went wrong. And so you can do testing. You can change the message, change the location of things. Put a picture so they see a picture. Have a video. Having a video on a page keeps them there, okay? Has them wanting to see more. Doing all these, there are all types of very content-specific things that you can do to maintain their interest. At the end of the day, though, did the person just look at the keyword and they're not really interested and say, yeah, and they leave? Okay? So you have a bounce rate. Now, associated, not with the bounce rate, but one of the keys that you have out there is measuring your return visitors, especially if you're a commercial site. You can have a site that has that's doing tremendous as far as attracting visitors, but are getting no return visitors, and so you're not getting the conversions. Very few people convert on their first visit.
And I think for a nonprofit, the return visitor is even more important because you're trying to establish that relationship.
That core. There's right. always the core audience right.
yes.
that you'll have.
Yes, and so continually measuring your return visitors, the percentage of return visitors over a period of time is another measure of the success of the site. So, with a commercial site that's selling, nobody ever buys the first time because everybody's comparative shopping. So your return visitor says that you're relevant. If your return visitors goes down, it's a real indication that you have a pricing issue.
So, Bill, in terms of best practices or real low-hanging fruit, are there a couple other things that come to mind that we haven't talked about already that people might be interested in knowing?
Okay, the answer is it depends on the customer. If I'm a commercial site selling a specific product, then I want to have the product generic category, not the brand name, the product generic category in the search. I want this to be repeated, and I want somebody who's going out there and who is looking for a left-handed transmission, that if they're going to be looking for that, they're going to find you. If I provide a service that has to be delivered, I want to make sure that it's geographically tuned. So that if I have a service in which I'm delivering mulch in Montgomery County, I want to make sure that Montgomery County is in the URL, in the titles, etc., out there. And so that the geo-gating that Google implicitly uses is going to help find the local people I'm looking for, because I don't want to sell mulch to Alabama. So if I'm attracting people there, it's not doing me any good. If I'm going out there and trying to reach political people, if I'm trying to reach an interest, I have to ask myself, what is the ideal demographic of this person? Okay, do I want to reach local constituents? Then I need some geo fencing on this. Do I want to reach people in a certain age group, etc.? Then I want to go into and find bloggers who are attracting these people and target them. I want to find tweeters who are followed in these areas out there, who are highly respected, that my demographic might look for and drive them to the site. A lot of people don't even know the issue exists. They don't know to search for it. They're not actively going out there and searching on complex issues. They have to become aware of it, and it has to be you that becomes aware. A reference from a well-respected source is the most valuable thing that you can do to increase traffic.
And that's a lot of boots on the ground, you know, emailing people, calling people.
It's building relationships. It's hard work. It's ongoing. It's back to the old PR agency, thing out there that the entire business is founded on. It's relationships. Building relationships and becoming a trusted source is the key to being found most, especially in the nonprofit issue world.
So what's the next big thing coming down the pike in analytics?
In analytics, it's all measurement, and the ability to organize the data to present it to the client so that they can make sense out of it is probably something that is a big niche out there that hasn't been filled. If you understand all the parameters, you understand what these things are, you can go in there and it helps guys like me make a living, because we demystify this and train our clients to do it. But if somebody could come back and say, hey, on this page, you really ought to tighten up your message, or the people that are coming here aren't interested, that's more relevant than giving them statistics on their bounce rate and their return rates and the page views and the dwell times, etc., because they can understand that. Because remember, people have key missions within an organization. Becoming a mathematical analyst is not the key mission of somebody who's out there who's involved in building followers or getting a message, etc., out there. They should understand it, but they can't always interpret analytical stuff. So tools that use maybe an AI approach.
Big data.
Big data. It's, you have data mining. The analytics is data mining. You've got a huge amount of raw data. What does it mean? What's important? Being able to demystify this to the user and have them translate what this means into actionable things so they can go back and interact with their developers or make changes to the site, retune their campaigns, to keep their message focused and to keep people coming to them and accomplishing their goals. That's the key. Friendlier tools.
And Bill, how often do you think, let's say you don't have a dedicated person on staff, you're working with a consulting agency, how often would you be setting up times to look at these numbers? Is it once a week, once a month, beginning, middle, end of a campaign? What's your, the clients you work with, how often are you actually going over their metrics and performance?
When you launch the site, you're looking at this thing every day. Okay, you want to see, you want to make sure that you're actually being picked up and that you're actually being reported on. You want to see the early things going in there. You're building, every time, if I have a link building campaign, I'm every day adding links. I want to see if, how the traffic is being affected by the links I'm doing this. So early in a campaign, you'd be looking at it I would be looking at it on a daily basis. If I'm within the organization out there, I'd at least want a weekly report. Here's the key. No surprises. I don't want to have a quarterly report. This isn't, by the way, our web activity is down 92%. You want to know there's a glitch when it happens, and you have to look at the timeliness of this. If an event happens in your niche, you want to be all over your analytics and see how that's affected. You want to take action immediately to be able to capitalize on these events to have them drive traffic back to you. So it's not a one-size-fits-all out there. Your standard deal is you generate a monthly report for a client. That monthly report really does not accomplish a lot. Unless it's a big, mature client and they just want to see the baseline and it increases 14%, and you can compare it to the previous year for the same period. You give them plots, etc. It says for 4 years, this is the trends, etc. That, you know, is for somebody that can afford it. But internally, part of what a consulting group does is to train the people on the importance on tracking the response of what's going on, to identify problems before they get out of hand, and to have a relationship or an organization in place that they can fix things if they go bad.
How often are you doing, how much do you do this? Is this a full-time job for you or a hobby or a part-time job?
I have ongoing clients. I have retainers. I've been getting retainers from some companies for 5 years. I'm not actively marketing myself, although I keep thinking I should. But I have about three jobs going on.
Are you in the market for any more clients?
Oh, I would love more clients.
And how would someone find you if they wanted some consulting?
Well, my name is Bill Strum. I can be reached at bstrum@verizon.net. I would be happy to talk.
There's
to
no him. Keywords in the URL of your email. Is that
no? There aren't. This all goes back that I sold my URL for a large sum of money some years ago. And now regret it. So I usually get found. People come to me and ask me if I can help them. And
referrals, basically.
Referrals. That's how my business is I'm doing right now. For those of you who are thinking of getting in the SEO business, if you want to be discouraged, go to Craigslist and see how many people will guarantee you a first place listing for $200. It's a tough business, and it's not really the business that you want to be competing in.
What do you
in.
Charge for that, $199?
Me?
Yeah. the difference is, though, you have a well-thought-out approach to this. It's not a gimmick. And I think that is probably maybe the point we should end on, which is there's a lot of shysters out there. How do you tell what you're dealing with?
What anybody that goes out there and makes a blanket guarantee that they're going to give you youth and happiness for a fixed amount of money is probably just going to buy some keywords, do a first order optimization. You want to look for people who are approaching this as a consultative engagement. And that the first thing that they want to do is discovery. And it's a mutual discovery. Within many organizations, they really don't have a well-thought-out vision of how somebody would describe their issue. What would I be asking in a search engine query to find it? What do I want to be found on? And then from there, you develop a strategy which converts into technical things that you do. You build pages that basically will address keyword phrases. I like to make sure that there's only one or two per page. People that go out there trying to do five or six or seven for a page fail. Look at the options of creating additional websites. Look for partnerships out there where people can drive traffic to you and link exchanges. Look at who my competition is. Anybody that doesn't talk about doing a competitive analysis to find out how your successful competitors are getting traffic isn't going to do you justice. That's actually a big job. Let your competitors have done the work for you, in fact. Look at all their links and all the places they are, and you go there too.
Because it's not only a process to improve your own rankings, but I'm sure you would want to know how you perform compared to your peers. So how would you do that? If you were just curious, you're listening to this podcast and you say, you know, there's you know, five other organizations out there like us. How do we rank compared? Should we be investing in SEO? How could you go out there and see what your performance is relative to your peers?
The very, very, very simple way of doing it is just to take the keywords that you'd like to be found on, type them into Google, and see what page you come out on.
That's a 30-second test.
That's a 30-second test. If you're at first, okay, you know you've done a good job. If you don't come up, and let's say you don't do this on one word or one phrase, pick 10 phrases. If you aren't in the first page for at least three out of your top phrases that don't contain the name of your organization, by the way, then you need to do some work out there to do that. There are professional tools out there that will generate you ranking reports that will go in there and they'll look at the top 200. They'll keep track of where you are on these keyword phrases, can do 100 at a time, look at all the search engines you want them to, give you a ranking report, and then run this automatically once a week and track your progress up and down within the ranking world out there. I highly recommend people either use somebody out there for their SEO who can generate these types of reports for them or get access to the tools that can do it themselves so that you know where they are. But again, they're very technical, they're time-consuming, and they're not inexpensive. The next thing you want to be able to do is to say, what's the secret of success? Here's the top guy, the top three guys out there in this category that I want. How are they doing it? Okay, who's linking into them? You can just do a links on Google, and it'll give you a list of all the links. Or you can use an analytics tool out there that will give you all the links of your competitors and the rankings of all the links into them and prioritize them. So now you have a targeted approach on where to go first to get the valuable links back into yourself. That's a real proactive, aggressive way of finding out what's going on and how to give yourself a quick kick for getting back up there. So you can do all these things. You can look at the technical content of your pages compared to what the ideal page ought to be for Google. And these profiles, at least in the ones that I subscribe to, sometimes they're updated two and three times a week because the engines get tuned very often. Every once in a while, there's a major change.
There's one coming up with Google, right, around mobile mobile searches, prioritizing mobile optimized pages, which yes. makes a lot of sense.
Yes, and this is an issue. Mobile optimized pages, we can have an entire another talk about. Okay, you want to make you will be penalized if your site is not mobile optimized now, which basically, if you use WordPress, that's covered. Although, if you convert a site to WordPress, you can actually end up with strange pages that you didn't know were out there that are terrible that Google will nail you on, but they will send you a message. So it's very important to stay current with Google Analytics. So unless you have an organization that has the depth to have a computer science staff, marketing staff, and e-marketing knowledge staff that knows the ins and outs of SEO, the real ins and outs of SEO out there, and you want to make sure that you're doing everything you can, you should rely on a professional as a partner whose key role is doing this. Where if I'm out there running an association that's trying to improve the labor conditions of some type of workers or teachers or students, it's not my key competency to go out there and do this. I shouldn't try and build this in-house. I should focus on things that are going to accomplish my goals. I should rely on trusted experts who can go in there and help me achieve these goals.
Well, Bill, this has been awesome. I think we're going to have to schedule parts 2 through 10. But thank you so much for coming. And,
my pleasure.
Sharing,
it always is.
Thank you, Bill.
Sharing the information with us. Let's get you some Sudafed.